Hello, and welcome to Required Reading, the podcast that revisits the most impactful books from our childhood. I'm your host, Erin Bowles. We have two guests. One is a returning guest, and all three of us worked together in college at a Girl Scout museum. Madeline Douglas is a pets and portraits painter, soon to be based out of Maine, and a fellow SCAD alum. That's our college. She is a Virgo, a lover of plants and rocks and shiny things, a bird watcher, and a semi-famous MLB shortstop of the New York Yankees. You will have to explain that. She is passionate about complaining. Welcome, Madeline.
Thank you, Erin. It's so good to see you. As for the MLB shortstop thing, I don't know. I
Yeah.
think that's just my dream career at this point.
Love it. That's all you need.
Thanks.
And our second guest is Luke Hanke. He is an archivist originally from Middle Georgia. He has a bachelor's in history and two master's degrees in public history and library and information. Luke started his career at the Juliet Gordon Low Birthplace in Savannah, Georgia. That's where he worked, which sparked his interest in women's history. Luke was first introduced to the Scarlet Letter in 10th grade American Lit. He has visited Salem, Massachusetts several times, and he has a particular interest in Puritans in America, which I'm very excited about. Hello, Luke.
Hi, nice to see you. Thank you for having me on. I
I'm so
appreciate it.
excited.
Very nice to be
Yeah.
reunited with both of you.
Yay.
I used to call Luke my work wife. Hope that's okay with
Honestly,
you.
we had working in any place, especially a museum, where you're dealing with so many people from all over really the world,
Yeah.
especially at our museum, you have to have somebody to just unload onto. And I
Yeah.
feel like to some degree, we all kind of provided that support system for
Oh,
each other.
yeah. Yeah. I just
Oh.
remember there were times that one of us would be at the front desk, and then one or both of us would finish a tour and come back and just be like, "This is what happened." Sometimes Luke would come down the stairs and be like, "Someone threw up. I have to take care of it."
Happened. It
Happened
happened.
more than you
Or
think. Yeah.
sometimes you were on like a solo tour with a couple and the wife of the couple just wanted to casually get down in front of the fireplace to pose for a picture while her husband was just taking a photo of her. It's you never knew what you were going to get there. It was fun.
I will
I
take
loved
that any
the, yeah.
day over the men who they need to fight you about the Boy Scouts. This is not that guy.
That happens a lot. Yeah, that happens a
So
lot.
much.
Or the people who come in and they're so steadfast in the fact that I'm a carpenter and I know this furniture better than you do. I don't fight you on that. I don't know the furniture. I know what it's called, maybe. I don't know how it's made. Tell me.
And our book today is The Scarlet Letter by Nathaniel Hawthorne from 1850.
Great transition. I love that.
Was great.
The biggest thing about Hawthorne is that his family has been in Salem and in Massachusetts since the place started. His ancestors were really brutal overseers of the Salem witch trials. He adds a W to his last name to kind of distance himself from that. Luke, I was showing Madeline, this is the most beat up copy of anything I have ever seen. Lizzie Wineline from fifth period, the like highlights are mine, but Lizzie Wineline from fifth period went ape shit. There's one point where Hawthorne's writing about Arthur Dimmesdale, who's one of the characters, and she writes, "Wuss." And I loved that. I highlighted that because
You
she was
know, I
right.
think that's iconic. I think that that pretty
Yeah.
much sums up the character of Arthur Dimmesdale.
100%. I
Yeah.
hope she got a good grade. I really
I
do. She
know.
deserved it.
She was highlighting vocab words, writing in definitions. She was trying. She was trying.
Damn, I could
She is
never.
far more of an overachiever than I was in 10th grade. Not to mention, we didn't have like we had like shared copy books, so you couldn't write in
Oh.
them. Like you
Oh.
had a class set of every book
Yes.
you read. So if you wrote in them, you'd get
Yes.
in trouble.
Yeah, you have to pay for it to replace it. Yeah.
I took American Lit twice. I was forced into it a second time. I went K through 10 at one tiny, tiny little school, but they allowed some of us ninth graders who were like more advanced to take the 11th grade American Lit class. So that was where I first found the Scarlet Letter. And then when I transferred schools to the Indiana Academy, it was a requirement that you had to take American Lit and then World Lit again. So I had already taken those in 9th grade and 10th grade. And then they made me do it again in 11th grade and 12th grade, which sucked. So I got to experience the fucking Scarlet Letter twice. My mom bought me whatever the copy from like Books a Million was. And so I still had it in 11th grade from 9th grade. And boy, mine looked a lot like Wine Lines. It was all beat up and colored in and written in. I had friends write in it, but I did not do well in either of those classes.
So Luke, how did you first encounter this book? You said 10th grade American Lit also.
While Madeline was talking, I was trying to think of the different lit classes that we had. And do I remember?
Oh, no.
Am I going to try to remember? No, I'm not. There's 2 years in there that obviously I blacked out for whatever reason. Can't imagine why.
You didn't love high school?
You know, it was probably one of the more traumatic times in my life, as it is for a lot of people. But it was honestly, like, I had a very nice kind of high school experience, had a really great set of friends. Two of them remain my best friends still today. Socially, I was fine. Mentally, not so much as a closeted gay man. You know, it's kind of a traumatic time for that kind of person. So when I think back on it, I'm like, okay, it was fine. But nowadays, I'm like, I have pretty fond memories of high school. But as far as like my academics went, I was just trying to keep up with everybody else because most of my friends were pretty smart. A lot of my friends were in AP classes. A lot of my friends were in honors. I was not in honors. I took AP classes just because you could sign up for them.
Yeah.
But I did all of the history classes.
That makes sense.
And I did
AP Psych. That makes a lot of sense.
I only passed AP Psych. I didn't pass the history classes. The test, that is. I passed all of my classes with A's. And then I took AP Bio senior year and then made a 1 on that test. And they were like, but I made an A in the class. And that's all that matters.
Exactly.
But yeah, so going back to what Aaron originally asked me. I was introduced to the Scarlet Letter in 10th grade American Lit. I always had a really hard time reading, like all throughout my childhood. I can't say that I was one of those people who like sat down with a book and then just like ingested all of it. I had a really hard time with reading in general. And then when you add Nathaniel Hawthorne's writing into the mix, it really doesn't help. Like, at all. Even when I sat down to try to read this book again, it just didn't work.
No.
It's that introduction. It's that 45-page introduction.
It's the book, really.
It's the whole thing.
Crack that thing open to the middle, and it's dry as hell, so not engaging any way, shape, or form. That's not to say it's not a good story, but his writing.
I just didn't understand the story because I couldn't read the story.
This is where SparkNotes comes into play.
This is exactly where SparkNotes comes into play. And Aaron, I don't know if you want to mention this, but do you want to preface like how we prepared for this and the kind of
go for it.
The kind of motif of this episode is the fact that a lot of us get by in high school and post high school with SparkNotes, and that's exactly what this episode's all about. Is pretty much treating it as a high school test. I think uniformly prepared ourselves with SparkNotes, maybe some Wikipedia,
just a little,
you know, just some online research just to try to get by. And with somebody like Nathaniel Hawthorne, I think that that's necessary because I feel like I would relate to a lot of people, a lot of students in the fact that, you know, reading was already difficult for me.
Yeah.
I can't say that I ever fully sat down to read any book that I was ever assigned. And yeah, a lot of people dog me for that. I have a degree in history. I have a couple of master's degrees. And that translated into my college experience and my grad school experience. Like, you do what you can to get by. But if you can't focus your attention to sit down and read text, you kind of have to do what you have to do. And that's very much my experience. Like, and again, I'll reiterate the fact that when you add Nathaniel Hawthorne's language into all of this, the 18th century trying to be 17th century words into all of this, it makes it a lot more confusing for a normal guy like myself to sit down and ingest what's being read. I could read a chapter. Could I tell you what happened in that chapter afterwards? Absolutely not.
No. And that's personally, it's so wild because at almost 30 years old, I'm struggling. I couldn't finish the book. I was like, this is terrible. It's just as boring and awful as I remember. But imagine being like 14, 15, 16 years old, trying to understand this language, trying to pull out of it the little themes and the subtext that you're supposed to, that your teachers and your professors want you to. And I was talking to my dad this morning on the phone, and I was talking about this podcast and the Scarlet Letter, and he goes, who the fuck read that? He's like, nobody read that. They've been wanting us to read that since the 70s and 80s. He's like, I never read it. He goes, I don't think I read a single book in high school except for anything that we read in class together. And I'm sitting here thinking, because there was definitely for me a point that I stopped reading, like the required reading. I stopped. Stop doing it.
Take a shot.
Donate
a dollar.
Oh no.
Every time, donate a dollar.
Oh, listeners. No. I don't have a dollar. Oh. But no, because I was like a like kind of a nerdy reading person. I loved books. I loved novels. I always carried around, you know, one of the Harry Potter books or Twilight or, you know, whatever. But there was definitely a point, and I was thinking about it, and I was going, I know that it was the American literature class, because that's when I hit my wall of like, you actually have to study for this shit, dummy. Mm-hmm. You have to read and think about it and be engaged in class and take notes and do all of the things that you don't do and somehow manage to eke by with A's anyway. So I hit that wall in ninth grade, and I was trying to remember the last book that I read before I just completely went over to the dark side and started using SparkNotes instead. And I swear to God, I think it was this fucking book. Wow. I think it was this one.
Because I did not read this book growing up.
Good for you.
Was it required?
It was not required. Well, and that was kind of part of the reason why I started this podcast is that my school, I don't want to be like my school was cool and different, but the curriculum, like we did read different books. So like there's a lot of things that I never read that, like, that's part of the reason why I want to do this podcast, which was so great that you guys both said this. And talking about our high school selves, very true to form, I read every page. I read it twice, once when we were scheduled to do it the first time, and then this time again. Here's my big take on the book, right? Some of these characters I adore. Like, there's really good stuff in here. This should have been a short story. There's so much editing. Yes. And it's like, come on, guy. Your 40-page introduction could be like a really good one page. This is too much.
I would be interested in reading a rewrite of this as a play.
Oh, yeah.
I wonder.
Yeah, and Luke is wearing a Scarlet Letter 1926 film shirt.
Oh, Lillian what Kachana. A beautiful segue.
I want that shirt.
No, we're literally going to be at least briefly, if not briefly, speaking about the film iterations of The Scarlet Letter. This one is featuring Lillian Gish. She was in the 1926 version of The Scarlet Letter on film. Not the first, but the first major production. I don't know if this is the time for it or if it's after we talk about the actual story.
It's loosey-goosey. It's whatever you want. I, within the last day or two, looked up like adaptations. I think you had mentioned movies. And I think the most recent one was it maybe 95 with Demi Moore as Hester Prynne, which I was like, sure.
Yes.
And then Arthur Dimmesdale was Gary Oldman. And I said, what? So I have a bee in my bonnet about Gary Oldman. I'm still not over him, trigger warning, strangling his wife with a telephone cord in the 90s. Yeah. I haven't forgiven him for that. And also, like, Arthur Dimmesdale, if your listener is unfamiliar with the story of The Scarlet Letter, it's Puritan, Puritanical Massachusetts. Hester Prynne is this woman who cheats on her husband. They force her to wear this scarlet A for adulterer on her chest for her entire life. She won't tell the town who the guy was, but she gets pregnant. And it is revealed that the guy is the preacher in the town, Arthur Dimmesdale. And one of the main attributes, coming back to Gary Oldman, of Arthur Dimmesdale is every single person is like, this guy's about to drop dead any second. We don't know how this man is alive. And so, like, Gary Oldman, I mean, not like the beacon of strength or something, but not like that is the thing that like little Timmy Chalamet like could look.
Yes.
I mean, he's too young, but like that's a gaunt person. So this is incorrect already, is my takeaway.
Now, because we're just on the topic right now, you mentioned Gary Oldman. I've just looked up the character list of the 1995 film. This is the only one where I see this person mentioned. But why is Tituba a character in the 1995 film? Because she's from The Crucible, which
what the
I will
fuck?
Say was my initial attraction to telling Aaron I would do this podcast is because I loved The Crucible. I reacted really well to that story. I think a lot of it has to do with my affinity for Winona Ryder and her being in the film.
That makes sense.
And yes. I've got the other two, the 1934 film and the 1926 film pulled up as well, the Wikipedia pages, which at some point I'm going to give a disclaimer about Wikipedia because it's not the villain that you try to make it to be. And as an information professional, I try to broadcast this to the world because it's been given a very bad name. Teachers and professors who don't know what the hell they're talking about.
Yes.
I'm going to tell you how to use it. It's not very difficult. You could probably figure it out by yourself, but it's not the villain everybody tries to make it out. But yeah, I had the Wikipedia pages pulled up for it. And Tituba is listed in the cast list as a character. And I'm like, that's
a different
story. Yeah. Tituba was in The Crucible.
Well,
however, let's take advice from Miss Emma Stone herself, who told us in EPA, we're going to talk about the film adaptions, right? So, you know,
yeah,
I consider that a film adaption. She told us herself to watch the older versions and not the one with Demi Moore, where she takes a lot of baths.
Yeah.
And now I get why she's saying that, only because I see Tituba in the character list.
So, The Scarlet Letter, I think, would be a really good short story. I think there's something about 19th century authors, especially in America, that they're all really good short storytellers. I don't really like short stories because I like to really sink into a novel. I want to see a lot. But this should have been, like, when he's good, he's fantastic. So, like, when I went in, my copy has an introduction to the second edition, which is only a page. And I was reading that, and he's like, a lot of people took issue with my first introduction, so I went over and I looked at it, and it was perfect. Have fun. And I read that, and I was like, how does Madeline hate this? And there's like, in that extremely long first introduction, he's ripping into his coworkers. He's like, this man is soulless. He's basically a dog. These latter qualities, indeed, being in barely enough measure to keep the old gentleman from walking on all fours. He possessed no power of thought, no depth of feeling, no troublesome sensibilities. And the whole time I was like, Madeline, this man is pure spite. How do you not like this? But I was on like page 20 at that point, and no mention, not a lick of Hester Prynne. So also valid.
That's the problem, though, is it takes way too many words to actually get to the point. And I think that in my, like, as I mentioned, already having trouble with reading long texts.
Yeah.
I just check out because I already don't understand, you know, the 17th century language. And then on top of that, you're trying to be descriptive as possible. And it's just not registering with me. And so I just don't understand.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to touch on this, and I don't want to like get too personal and like ask you. But like when you were talking about your issues with reading, Luke, because like I'm finding myself, I've got my anxiety and my depression and my OCD under control, and now I'm being evaluated for ADHD.
Yes.
And
yes.
And I cannot
Same.
Focus on anything at all.
Literally.
And so
therapy brought me to that point where
there
was a lot of like common occurrences throughout my life. And I've never been diagnosed with ADHD.
Yeah.
And I am literally in the, I don't know what you call it. Like I'm starting to be evaluated for it and whatnot.
Yeah.
Because there were so many like common threads throughout my life about me not being able to like latch on to that. And it's never been a thought of mine because typically I thought that I was, you know, normal child. I wasn't jittery. I wasn't the stereotypical characteristics.
The gifted kid. Yeah.
And so through therapy, I realized like by talking through things that could be something that has affected me my whole life. I just haven't realized it. I really think that that could be a possibility. I haven't been diagnosed or anything with it yet, but yeah, I'm actually in that phase where I'm being tested for it and kind of evaluated to figure out whether or not that's a possibility. And if it is, like, it would draw a lot of conclusion to a lot of the questions I had throughout my life. And if it's not, then, you know, at least I get to figure out what the problem really could be.
Yeah, it takes you a step forward.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because that's exactly where I'm at in my life, just the last couple of months. So that's very local for me.
I think you and I are kind of right in that same step. I recently started seeing a counselor who's just a talking counselor, and she doesn't diagnose or anything like that. But like within the first session, she's like, because I was explaining, I'm becoming my father, is essentially what this is that just the thought pattern and process of how I do things and make decisions, and I'm going insane. And she goes, this sounds a lot like ADHD, and I think you and your dad should be tested for that. And I went, oh no. Aaron and I have talked a little bit about it, but Luke, it sounds like you as well. But I have a feeling this is a trio of like the gifted and talented kids we're sitting here. And I always joke that my gift, if you will, is that I'm an absolute dumbass, dumber than a box of rocks. I still somehow made A's. I didn't read. I didn't study. I didn't. Yeah. I was good at teachers. Teachers liked me. Yeah. And now, oh.
Yeah. I really, so, yeah. Now that you mentioned that, it seems like there's a lot of similarities. Because same, I'm like, I was not good at performing school necessarily. I could memorize stuff to get through tests. And I made virtually all A's in school without reading. And that's, like I said, going into grad school, going through college, going into grad school, like I kept that same kind of routine because I could not sit down to read a book.
Yeah. And I mean, it was
to let you know, like I might have ADHD, I don't know. And I'm sort of just like sitting on it. But to read this, I was, and it's for almost any book I read, but not all, but especially for the podcast, I was on a treadmill, and after every page, sometimes every paragraph, I would up the speed by one, so I would be like, while reading it, and I think that helps me focus on it. But you could also be like, okay, this whole paragraph is about roses, and I get the symbol, come on, man.
Yeah, I've spent my entire life, even books that like, this is so stupid, I'm rereading the Twilight series.
That's this whole podcast, baby. That's not stupid.
But I find something new every time. I think I skim through every book that I read, even just in for leisure. But the ADHD thing, man, that makes me think back. I'm going, God, what did I miss in high school? I don't remember most of it.
I can't even remember those two lit classes. So obviously I missed
I remember those. They were brutal. Again, everybody has their own unique experience or whatever, but because there were 50 people in my class, I think in the 7th through 12th grade building, so the junior senior high school, there was like 250 people total. And I want to say that included like faculty and staff. Tiny, tiny school, which now in retrospect, as an adult who has wisdom and shit on my side, reading the Scarlet Letter about this tiny little community and how everybody knows everybody's business and is all up in each other's shit. And then we read that in that tiny little school where it's the same thing. I'm drawing the parallels now, but like back then I was dumb. But yeah, I stopped reading. And then so I think 9th grade was American Lit, and then we took Brit Lit, and then 11th and 12th grade, we kind of got to pick and choose because it was the Gifted and Talented Academy or whatever, the smart people school. But you had to take American Lit and World Lit. And then I don't think we had the opportunity to take like the AP language and AP Lit. I was like, absolutely not. So I took dramatic literature. And that is the way to do it. Didn't read a book. Again, didn't read a book. But in dramatic lit, we were reading together. We were reading plays in class right there. And then he would stop us and we'd talk about it. And that is the way they need to teach the children. Also, this is another thing. Speaking of the children, how are they doing it in today's world? Do they still teach this book in school? Can you guys imagine with like AI and ChatGPT and all that shit trying to teach this book, trying to learn this book? Nope.
Yeah. Which actually, with the big classics, we discussed this a lot on my Huck Finn episode, which I really appreciated. Is like, I don't know about right now, but certainly with Huck Finn, like, why do we teach these books? Just because they're old doesn't mean that they're good. What my guest on that episode, Niles Abstin, said is like, because not everybody gets to college, not everybody continues to read for leisure. So you have to be like, we have to shove all of literature for like the rest of your life into a couple years. So we're going to give you the good stuff when you're not ready for the good stuff, which is flawed. But I think that's sort of the mentality. But I also know like my high school never taught it. And I got nosy and looked up like my county's current curriculum. And at least there, and I'm from like a very liberal area, they're putting like all contemporary and like around the world literature. God knows if children are reading. God only knows.
Because that's what my thought on it would be. Wouldn't you want to inspire them to want to read? Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, but Nathaniel Hawthorne does not do that.
I will say, because you mentioned the author's name again, that this is a nice time to at least insert a little anecdote.
Hell yeah.
The other book that I've read from Nathaniel Hawthorne was in college at Armstrong State University in Savannah, Georgia. And it was The House of Seven Gables. And it was in one of my history classes. My professor divided the class up into three groups and gave us three different American novels to read. And we had to come up with some way to teach the class about our book. And I've been to The House of Seven Gables in Salem, Massachusetts. Where, if I'm not mistaken, Nathaniel Hawthorne grew up part of his childhood there. And that's kind of what gave him but he at least lived there for a period of time. But that's what gave him the inspiration to write The House of Seven Gables. And it's a very interesting home. Like, there's secret secret passages, you know, through the chimney. And
I have to remind the audience, we all worked at a historic house museum together. And that's how we met each other. So,
every time I go to a historic house, I'm like thinking about the story, like, what history happened here? And this is all a plug for me to tell you how we taught our class about the House of Seven Gables.
Granted,
this wasn't my idea. I kind of thought it was stupid at the time, but it was probably a group of 5 to 7 of us that had to read this book together and then come up with a way to teach our class about it. Somebody in the group came up with the idea of doing a sock puppet show for the House of Seven Gables to teach our class about the story. And so we all made our own little sock puppets of all the different characters. Like I said, there's probably about 7 or 8 of them. And we ended up like doing the whole shebang. And this is a very hard professor to impress. Like he was a professor in his 60s. He was from South Philly, very hard to impress. And he loved our depiction of the House of Seven Gables as a sock puppet show. Like, it could have gone one of two ways. It could have really fell off and he would have thought that we are the dumbest people in the world. But it went the complete opposite direction where he doesn't show emotion when you're doing something. And so he's just like over there in the corner, like,
and stone faced.
He was like, that's one of the best projects I've ever seen my students do in my time of teaching. And he went on to use that as an example for a really creative way to teach the class a lesson. So I just had to have that little plug because it's an Hawthorne plug. I don't get to know a lot of people about my experience as a sock puppeteer.
Given me a great idea, the next movie adaptation of The Scarlet Letter, The Muppets.
The Muppets. Like The Muppets. Oh, damn, cast it now.
The Muppets.
Yeah, Miss Piggy as Hester Prynne.
Yes.
Like some of the morals really transpose very well.
Oh my God. Mm. We got to have our one person. Who's going to be our one actor?
The one person?
I almost feel like it should be Chillingworth.
Yeah.
I think it's Chillingworth.
Yeah. Chillingworth, Hester's husband, who is living in the town and no one knows that
he's
they
the
were married.
Troll. The ultimate troll.
Yes. Yeah.
Everybody to be like, hey, I'm this doctor. But really, I'm going to like try to get this guy who, you know, messed with my woman to die.
Yeah. So Hester has moved into this town from somewhere in Europe, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. There is a character in this book who is like, that is the witch. We all know she is a witch and we are all allowing it. We're all totally fine. Mistress and she Hibben. Is the governor's sister. What frustrates me about this book is like, it is, when it's good, it's really good. Like, I do want to publish an edited version of like, these are the good parts, because like, there's a great moment where Hester and her husband, who, you know, is going undercover, are talking, and he's like, it was wrong of me to marry you. You were too young. And I weighed you down. And there's some beautiful language of like, here, my heart was a habitation large enough for many guests, but lonely and chill and without a household fire. I drew thee into my heart, into its innermost chamber, and sought to warm thee by the warmth which thy presence made there. And he goes, we have wronged each other. What's interesting is that the gender roles here are really, really interesting. And Chillingworth is like, I'm fine with you, but I'm going to go after this man. And the whole thing is like, the whole book is like frustrating because it's a great message of like, women have to live with the consequences of men's actions. And I think one of the biggest questions I had two, which were, why does Hester, before the events of the book, why of all the people in town does she choose this guy, Arthur, to have the affair with? Yeah. And I don't know if I mentioned it while we were on mic. I have a very, very heavily annotated copy from like a 10th grader who left it in the Little Free Library. And she wrote at one point, Arthur Dimmesdale is talking, and she wrote, wuss. And we all agree with her. This guy sucks, but is a great character.
He's got a position of power in that town. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's a minister, preacher, whatever the hell he is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say that is probably had some charm on him, you know.
Mm. People aren't gonna, but also,
he's great at like what he does. Yeah.
But does he seem, he doesn't seem super threatening or anything. So, I mean, maybe sort of a position of power. So there's a little bit of an idea of safety for her.
Yeah.
But he's also not like demanding, or, you know, and he's got to keep this secret as much as she's got to keep this secret. You know, he's a man of the church. She's married.
Mm-hmm. Now that we're talking about it, I'm seeing it as like, she maybe comes from somewhere else. We know that in the events of the novel, she is definitely an outsider, but her husband isn't there. So she probably felt like an outsider. And it's like your job as the preacher to like tend to your flock and be welcoming and be inviting. I really see that. I really see that a lot now. See, now that we've discussed it, I've reached a new level of understanding, which is what English class should be.
If we want to go a step further, could Hester be a villain?
I love Hester.
Could she be a villain? Could she have gone in, and maybe this is an undescribed, who wrote this shit?
Hawthorne?
I was Hawthorne? Anyway. Maybe Hawthorne didn't include this piece where she went in and seduced him. Maybe she was like, hey, I need some, you know, I don't know how vulgar.
So you're sounding like a citizen of Salem. I feel like you're saying this hussy, this temptress.
I'm playing, for lack of a better advocate. Word, the book calls the black man, the devil.
Yes, the black man's advocate.
I'm playing the devil's advocate. What if she was a temptress and she went in and seduced him? And was like, hey, I'm sexy and I have the goods. Let's have the dirty deed.
She planned it
all. Well, she certainly like,
she could have.
I like the idea of she planned it all. But then it is like what does she
came
benefit?
From the old world to the new world by herself. She has to have some street smart.
She wants
and her husband isn't there. So there is that like lack of, I could get away with it. She's had to like establish herself without a man present.
There's no social media.
And she's also could be like, let's go crazy. I am going to have fun. I'm a liberated woman. It seemed like she didn't think he was going to come over.
Didn't they assume that he was lost at sea because it took him so long?
That's what the town assumed.
Because he was captured by the Native Americans.
So maybe she thought that too. And she was like,
he's lost. Got to go get somebody else.
Yeah. She's like, this is my chance to be by myself, independent, strong.
It reminds me of Betty Draper kind of character of like a bored housewife. What do I have to do? And someone is nice to me and pays attention to me. I see that also.
Literally, yes. She's sitting there like sewing all day. Like, yeah. You got to get bored. Mm-hmm. You got to use your hands for something else. Like, let's go out in the town and get me a man.
Oh, no.
That's the thing. Like, here's the thing. If birth control was reliable, everyone in this book would have had a great time. Oh, everyone yeah. in this book would have had fun.
Everybody in the history of forever would be great.
Would have had fun.
And now I want to mention this too, because this also pulls in like a little bit of a historical perspective.
Yeah.
The fact that these are all Puritans in this village, and they would have believed in predestination. So mm-hmm. like, mm-hmm. if they believed in predestination, wouldn't they have pegged Hester Prynne as like a heathen from the get-go? Like, why all of a sudden, ooh. Because she, you know, had this, you know, act and she had a baby, is she now going to go to hell? She's the one that's, you know, the outcast.
Right.
She would have been predestined from birth to go mm-hmm. to hell.
But don't, didn't they kind of just not like women anyway?
Probably that certainly comes up in like how the whole conversation around Pearl, her daughter, which by the way, yeah. I love that her name is Pearl. A little grain of sand gets caught in the oyster. They 100% talk about Pearl as like, she is born out of a sinful act. Everyone is like, is Pearl doomed? Also, is she human? But this child is like, is she predestined to be evil? And I don't have any answers about Pearl other than go off, have fun.
I've never even thought about like the non-human thing, but the fact that you mentioned that makes me think of the American Horror Story season where the aliens come down and impregnate the humans and then make this like sub-species. It's the one where they went underground. It's Apocalypse. There
okay.
It was the second part of Apocalypse. And it's all about aliens coming down and literally men were being impregnated and having children. Wow. It was very interesting. Oh my gosh. There was like a subplot of Mamie Eisenhower. Literally, like, it's so stupid, but I really appreciated this season. Like,
this is Ryan Murphy, right? Ryan Murphy did American Horror Story.
Sidebar. But literally, like, just her not being human. Like, mm-hmm. so, okay, if she's not human, would she be, like, Rosemary's Baby-ish?
I think it was my ninth grade teacher. She put such an emphasis on how they described Pearl as impish.
Yes, and like, sprightly, fairy-like.
Not sprightly and
fairy-like, like a brownie from the Girl Scouts.
Yeah, I was thinking about it too, Luke. They reference like foundlings, like sort of the British Celtic idea of like your baby gets replaced in the night with like a demon baby.
Oh my goodness.
So I,
kind of on board with that. Cause like I was saying before, I don't give Pearl a pass because she's like the mm-hmm. bastard child of Hester Prynne. She was also kind of manipulative if you think about it. And her entire life, she's been like touted around as this scarlet letter in mm-hmm. these elaborate dresses. And her mother just like makes her all of these nice clothes just to cover up her sin, but also just to parade her sin all around town to be like, hey, bitches, you got to live with us.
You're painting Hester as like a succubus. And Arthur is like the victim here. And then chilling.
Poor little Arthur, man coming on my podcast and siding against Hester Prynne.
I wanted to offer those ideas because, like, obviously it's easy to come in and be like, Hester was mm-hmm. the victim. She's the woman. She is. Yeah.
Well, she chooses to stay. That's the crazy thing. And, like, why I love her as a character. She, not like I want to be around her, but, like, fascinating character.
That idea alone is the fact that maybe she's a narcissist. Maybe she likes the attention.
Something that she and Arthur Dimmesdale definitely share, and to be honest, is it just a, like a puritanical mindset? I think it is. Of like, we have to live in self-flagellation. Like he's actually whipping himself, but like we both get off on being sinners, living with the sin.
Yeah.
God, my life is so hard. Yeah, like absolutely infuriating.
Masochism a little bit. They both enjoy the pain because like not only does she stay the first time around, like as soon as she gets pregnant, why didn't she just
could leave.
Disappear? But then afterwards, she comes back. She leaves.
Yes, Pearl after the plot of a whole
why does she come back if not to just sit there and ruminate in her pain?
Hawthorne writes it as like she knows she has a place in society. And I know that often the conversation around this book is like people are hypocritical and how dare they do this to Hester Prynne. But what makes her so interesting is that she, like, there's some line where it's like Hester had a place in the community. Like that is a job in the community. So then in my mind is like, well, someone's got to be it. Is like, she like trying to like herself? Save someone else? Like someone, then it's going to turn. Is she saving Miss Hibbins from getting got because she's a witch? They have greater priorities. Yeah, there's, I'll try to find that line of like, she has a place.
I don't like the idea that they're trying to give her like an out by being like, oh, she gave to charity. She started being more charitable. I'm like, oh, stop it.
Yeah.
You're not doing
so that. A huge question I had was, why does she keep his name secret? Why does she keep that secret that it's Dimmesdale?
Yes, that's a great question. And I think it's because she's a narcissist and she wanted all of the attention.
Yeah, because there's like a savior complex.
Yes.
Diagnoses.
I saved him. I saved him. I'm the moral authority, even though she's not.
Or is she like, I get to live with it. I get to have it out and I'm going to make you suffer with it. It's an infliction of like, she understands that like, I can bear with it on the outside. It is going to hurt you more internally to have this way on yourself.
That still makes her the villain.
Well, that's a signing of it. Well, I love her. Have fun, Hester.
She's emotionally manipulative and abusive. So I'm still not giving her an out on that one. I'm just out.
Sure.
Since I've gone on this diatribe, I'm really trying to make her out to be the villain.
Hester really filled a gap which must otherwise have remained vacant. And here is like the masochism in it, which again, is that just like inherent in Puritanism? To Hester Prynne, it might have been a mode of expressing and therefore soothing the passion of her life. Like all other joys, she rejected it as sin.
Oh yeah, we got to talk about sin. I mean, I know we've talked about the Puritan thing already, but like, and I don't know if I'm like over hyper analyzing this because of Cowan was a small white Christian population.
Oh God, learning about the Scarlet Letter in a Christian environment.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
I don't know. My community is not, we're Baptist around here. Most people are.
Yeah.
Not my family, but I grew up around primarily Baptist people, which is very much like fire brimstone-ish.
Yeah.
You're going to go to hell if you think about sex before marriage. And so very much I feel like kids in my class would have caught on to the fact that like, she's a sinner and she's gonna burn.
Do you remember that from your classes, like how it was received and how it was like taught to you by teachers?
My teacher was from Michigan, and so he wasn't from like our area. I feel like it might have been taught a little differently if it had been somebody like an older school kind of person. And he was also quite young.
So liberal gay.
Like might have been a little different if we had like an older person teaching us this book, especially if there were somebody like, my parents weren't really religious. We never went to church growing up, but I did start going around middle school age to a church with some neighbors. And that church was very much Southern Baptist. It was very much like, if you think sinful thoughts, you know, you're sinning, you're a horrible person. It was very much like toxic.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
So if it had been somebody like from that community, it would have been a much different storytelling, you know, interpretation of the book. But yeah, how was, you said Cowanism?
Cowan, the school and the little community didn't even have a stoplight. You know, it used to have a post office. It didn't by the time I got there, but just the tiniest, tiniest little community. And literally everybody knows everything about everybody. They are all like everybody, you know, their parents went to Cowan, their grandparents went to Cowan. Like the guy that was one of my best friends growing up, I think like his grandfather or something like built the fucking school. And then they all marry each other.
Yeah.
And then their kids go to Cowan. There were a couple of girls that got pregnant at, you know, 15, 16 years old. And they weren't like ostracized or anything, but it definitely changes the way people talk about them. You know, there's always like Susie Q. Oh, she got pregnant at like 16.
Oh,
you know, it always brings that in. And so that I'm drawing those parallels
now,
like
as
an adult. Yeah. As
she's like an object of pity.
Yeah.
Yes. they're definitely talked down to and talked down about, regardless of what happens, regardless of if they stay together with, their partner, or if they grow up and become a career person, that mark will always stay with them in
They
that
have
community.
a metaphorical scarlet letter on them for the rest of their life.
Yes.
Yeah.
Their pearl,
They
yeah,
got
certainly.
the brand, yeah. Well, even if they get away, they're still tied to it because, they in high school,
Family.
actually the baby, I don't want to like talk down on the baby daddy. Well, you know what? You villainized Hester Prynne, so I'm gonna villainize men.
We're
But
doing
the thing
everything
is, yeah,
today.
even if the girl gets away, it's usually the guys that stay and then they marry another girl from
Yeah,
high
no,
school.
that's completely valid.
Then she and her kid are now still tied to that little tiny community. And it's weird to think about this story at my age. And, because
Yeah.
my roommate is here and known each other since we were 4 years old. Okay. So we went through to school together. We've been best friends for a long, long time. And it's always really funny. She'll talk to her parents on Sundays or whatever. And I'll be like, all right, what's the gossip from back home?
The
What are we talking about? What did Kathy tell you? Give me all the tea. There are people that I literally have not spoken to in more than 10 years. And yet it's just, there's something about being from a small group of people that you
Yeah.
got to know everything about everybody. And it makes me feel very
Yeah.
guilty, which is another theme in this book, guilt.
Yes. Guilt is smattered all
Yeah.
throughout this book.
Here it is. I'm just have it open to a page.
Oh my God.
The guilty one stands looking on at this sad spectacle, unknown of man, and forgetting that God sees him.
God sees everything.
So maybe what I want to talk about next is gender roles. Because what's fascinating is that Hester Prynne is this pillar of strength, and Arthur Dimmesdale is so fucking baby weak,
He's a
which
cuck.
people would,
Yeah.
he, I hate this guy.
Yeah.
I
Yeah.
hate
He's
this guy.
the worst.
I think something that is good is like it works up to a really great kind of like boil. I think like the drama escalation, it takes too long in terms of words and like page number, but over the arc, it's like a fraction. It's
Yeah.
all times three. And if you shut it down to one third, it'll be good. But in those scenes near the end, he's like physically leaning on her, like saying, like, Hester, take care of me. But there's also like it's so good to read those scenes, and it's just like me and my here. He asks Hester if she's found peace. And she says, "Have you?" And he goes, "None, nothing but despair. What else could I look for, being what I am and leading such a life as mine?" He asks, "How are you?" She asks, "How are you?" And he goes, "Thank God. Let me talk."
Yeah.
Just absolutely awful.
As a drama
Me to my
person,
therapist.
I can identify with that because I would probably do the same thing. I'm like,
Oh, yeah.
hey, how are you? And
Yeah.
then not really care about what the other person says, but like, let me tell you about my pain.
Yes. Well, that's you always get, you have to ask them first how they are, and then they'll give you like the small talk, like, oh, I'm fine. Thank you
Oh,
so much.
great.
How are you? And then I'm like,
Okay.
great. Let's sit down. Here we go.
Let's unpack.
That's the thing about Arthur Dimmesdale is like I just know him. Chillingworth, whatever the husband is, and Hester are like so rich. They feel like
Yes.
richer than the people I've ever known. That's the frustrating thing about this book is like again, when it's good, it's good. Like that
Yeah.
character is so good.
And then Dimmesdale is just, and I like, I don't know if this makes me an absolute bitch or not. It probably does. But like,
Go for it.
he's like one of those people, one of those characters that like, you just don't think of him, not to go back to Mad Men. You tacked that in there a little
Why
bit, but
not?
like that scene in the elevator where he's like, I don't like you. And Don goes, I don't think about you at all. Like, Dimmesdale's there. Like, he sucks. But like, unless he's
Yeah.
right there in front of me, I'm like not even a character in this book. Like, he's just kind of this
Oh.
passing, abstract thought. Like, yeah, he was he's the baby daddy. Great, awesome. I
Well,
don't
I
give
have such an
a fuck.
opposite thing. But I
Like
think
he
it's like
was
all that,
so like too
yeah,
present
because
for
he
you.
was, no, not that he was too present, but like I had such a visceral reaction to him. I
Oh,
like
okay.
had such strong feelings about him. And I don't know if that's like me. It's just like, oh, you're the little twit. You're the little
Yeah.
worthless booger that we're going through all this shit for. I think that's the thing. I'm so focused on him.
I think this is one of my like personal defense mechanisms or whatever. And I used to employ this as a child as well. But anybody I don't like, just don't think about them.
Just block it.
Yeah. Like any of the kids that used to bully me or whatever, I'd be like, why on earth should I care what you think? You know? And that's
wow, damn.
I very much gave all of the bullies all of my attention.
Though. Oh, well, there weren't many after a while.
I was the opposite.
But I just bullied myself.
Some of us do that, but I do think that it's easy to have such a hatred for Dimmesdale because I think all of us have known somebody who's a Dimmesdale.
This is the hero of the story for Luke.
No, I'm just saying. I'm getting defensive. You know, all of us have known somebody who like just kind of cowers after they've done something wrong and can't own up to it. And so they're just like, man, I'm going to go.
And loves it. Yeah. Rolls in it.
And the hypocrisy of him preaching to the rest of the people, you need to, you know, confess your sins before God or whatever.
He's and then begging her, tell them my name. Please tell them my name. Yeah.
But like, why can't he tell them his name?
Yeah.
Because he's
that's,
a cuck.
Wait, what's weaponized incompetence?
Yes. Yes. That is a great way to put it.
And
absolutely.
At the end, he dies. He tells the truth and he doesn't even say it directly. He doesn't, he never says, I'm Pearl's father. I did it. He confesses, quote unquote, and then immediately drops dead. And I'm like, absolutely. Yet again, the women have to live with the consequences of men's actions. Yet again.
You just get to escape the world by dropping dead after the comet comes.
And
all of
yet,
a sudden,
she chooses to come back. And
that's why she's the frickin' villain.
She's certainly the villain to herself. But also fascinating. It's to the point where like her choices are so beyond comprehension for me that they're past the point of comprehension. So they get to the point of respect.
You have to think about the context that she's living in.
Yeah.
She's, for lack of a better word, groomed to think these thoughts and that she is the bad person.
So Chillingworth is man versus man. Dimmesdale is man versus self, or is he man versus God? And then she's man versus the other one.
The world?
I mean, I don't know if she's man versus God, because she's just kind of, she's a man versus society, essentially. Because she's standing up and kind of doing her own thing a little bit. Or is she man versus self, because she is her own worst enemy?
Yeah, maybe it's man versus self, because she's in her own mind. And that's something really interesting, is that she, by leaving society, like basically has the Enlightenment era on her own. Fantastic. Yeah. Fascinating.
Everybody needs one.
And then the minister is like, I think Pearl like holds his hand or like says something nice to him. And Hawthorne's like, it is so incredible to have a child take interest in you as an adult, as Dimmesdale, because, quote, therefore seeming to imply in us something worthy to be loved. Sorry. He like loves that Pearl takes an interest in him, because a child's interest in an adult means that there's something worth loving in that adult's self.
But it took her forever to even have any interest in him at all. She didn't like him.
No, she didn't.
That seems like a cop out.
I think he's grasping at straws.
Write a book about Pearl. How about that? How does she turn
I out? Do want to know what Pearl's life is like.
Make it a short story.
Pearl would go and marry a rich man and then poison him. Inside that house would be a Hitchcock film.
Also, every time House of the Seven Gables is mentioned, my brain just immediately translates it into Anne of Green Gables. And I'm like, it's not the same thing. It's not the same thing.
Absolutely the same thing. White picket fence, pigtails, and a straw hat. Love
it. But like the fact that there are two books that have gables in their title.
I mean, gables is an architectural term. It pretty much means any point in a house that's like a triangle. So those of y'all who don't know, a gable is the pointed roof kind of deal. And this house in Salem, Massachusetts just so happens to have seven gables. So
weird number.
It is a strange number.
Because I feel like
How many gables did Anne's house have?
I don't know, but they were green.
What else can you say?
I love this.
Here's an interesting question asked by the text itself. I don't know who's saying this, but it's in quotes. Is Hester Prynne the less miserable, thank you, for that scarlet letter on her breast?
Say that again. I'm sorry. I have to.
Is Hester Prynne the less miserable, thank you, for that scarlet letter on her breast?
Is she the less miserable, thank you?
Think you. Just like, do you think she's less miserable because she has that scarlet letter on her chest?
Well, I think she's less miserable because she's a narcissist.
Okay. Well then.
I mean, it's a confession without a confession, right? She already did the hard part. She said it out loud. And now she's wearing this letter around and everybody knows what it means. So she doesn't have to talk about it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think maybe.
I think the book kind of goes down that route where she first it's like, wow, it's just so hard. It's very difficult. You know, you're imprisoned and then you have to live with this literal icon on your chest everywhere you go and everybody ostracizes you. But then after a while, like she starts doing charity, she kind of proves her worth to the community. And so, and after you've lived in pain or in such a horrible situation for so long, eventually I imagine you would adapt. I mean, I feel like that's a human response, is just to adapt to whatever surrounding you're in, whether it's good or bad.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, I imagine she became less miserable, and she also didn't have anything that she was hiding. So it's not like Dimmesdale where he's hiding constantly these the horrible actions that he partook in. Everything was found out and she was able to live her life as relatively comfortably as she could. So I imagine that would be a more pleasant place to be in than somewhere like Dimmesdale, where you have this fear that every single day somebody's going to find out and then you're going to be the one on trial. And not having that weight on your shoulders, I imagine would be a much more healthy place.
Yeah.
Despite having the trauma of being convicted and, you know, having been ostracized from your entire community, I think that would be a better place, you know, mentally to be in.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, she's like, she's admitted she has a problem. Like, she's admitted she committed this sin. So that then allows her.
It's sort of like, what else can they do to you? Like, you've played your card.
I've got a question.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no.
Where does Sexaholics Anonymous fit into puritanical Massachusetts Bay Colony?
Well, that's the thing.
There was an organization like this. Would this have ever happened? If it had happened and, you know, if it had still happened, like, would she have become a member? Would Dimmesdale have become a member?
I think it's the conditions. It's not like having too much sex. It's like not having enough that makes you explode.
Yeah.
It's like we're told that sex is bad so much that it becomes the only thing you can think about.
Yeah.
Yes. Yep. If they had migrators, everything would be great. This wouldn't even be a book.
And yet again, we've solved it.
Perfect. Amazing.
Nathaniel, get on the line.
Yeah.
I do have something that I want to mention about the movie.
Yeah.
This is specifically about 1926, Lillian Gish, as I've mentioned before, because as you know, an archivist, I looked up an interview from her talking about the Scarlet Letter. And this is kind of random. This doesn't really have to do with the plot at all. It's just talking about a little bit about like the film itself. And so I wrote down a couple of quotes. She says, Luby Mayer said the story was banned. And for those who don't know, Lillian Gish, I didn't know this until I watched this interview. Lillian Gish is often referred to as the first lady of American cinema. So that's fun. I'm also kind of new to Lillian Gish. I also don't really like silent films. So I had a hard time watching the silent film of The Scarlet Letter. The only other silent film star that I know is Gloria Swanson, which is a fun tie-in to Aaron and I's time at the birthplace, because she would literally reenact, like, I feel like scenes from Sunset Boulevard. Like, I feel like we would do like back and forth sometimes of Gloria Swanson specifically in the kitchen.
I remember back and forths all the time, but I don't remember Gloria Swanson.
I feel like you did an impression of Gloria Swanson at some point. Like, it stuck with me for some reason. So
the thing I remember the most, our most common back and forth, was I watched some viral video from a Mickey Mouse cartoon. And it's like Daisy trips. The music goes crazy. Mickey Mouse freaks out. He runs over and instead of what happened, he goes, "Whoa!"
Whoa!
Whoa!
Oh,
Luke would just come down the stairs, and all of us, we would stare at each other, and I would go,
So, clip from
yeah, Lily and Gish.
This is from Canada's public broadcaster archives, and it's Lily and Gish giving an interview about the movie that she made, the silent film that she made in 1926. And she says, Luby Mayer said the story was banned. Oh, we know that story, saying Mayer said this. We wanted to do it ourselves, but you can't. It's banned. So Lillian says, banned? It's taught in the public schools. It's an American classic. I'm an American. I object to that. What do you mean? And so Mayer says, you get them to lift the ban and you can do it. And so Lillian wrote to churches and women's clubs, and they said that she was responsible for the film, that she could do it. And she picked the actors and the director, including Mr. Seastrom, which was a Swedish director from, obviously, Sweden. and it included, so he, I guess he was like one of the first Swedish actors in American film, at least. So the guy who plays Dimmesdale in the 1926 film was a Swedish actor named Lars Hansen, who apparently, according to Lillian Gish, did not speak a lick of English. So I'm sure that that was fun. Not that they're speaking in the film anyway, but I'm sure for, like, you know, camaraderie's sake, that was not very, that was not a very good time. Yeah, I thought that was an interesting point of her interview, just talking about how she was so instrumental in having the film made in the first place. Yeah. Like I said before, this is not the first, the 26 film was not the first iteration of it to be on film, but this is probably the first famous iteration of the film. The first sound film that was made is from 1934, and that I watched that one, and that one's pretty good. It's pretty, I would say, accurate to the text.
That's the one with Colleen Moore, isn't it?
It is, yes. And that was her last movie that she ever did.
I love her. Have you guys seen her Dollhouse?
I don't know much about her, to be honest.
If you're ever in Chicago, you got to go to the Museum of, like, Science and Industry or something like that, because her dad built her this, like, giant dollhouse that, like, she could crawl into. If you Google this, you'll see all the pictures of her. Everything is, like, I mean, it's, like, gilded with, like, gold and gemstones and, oh.
That sounds like the Kardashians before there was Kardashians.
Yeah.
Something I always try to focus on in the podcast, or at least mention, is, like, do you think your views of it have changed in any way?
Yes.
Madeline is nodding very big. Say more.
Yes. Yes. 14-year-olds, 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds, anybody under 20. Well, anybody under like 23. Stupid. They've never seen anything. They've never done anything. They don't know anything. Emotions are huge, and like little itty bitty tiny things. It's the end of the world. To think about this book as a teenager, when you just can't really relate to anything. And especially if your teacher doesn't help you in that sense, if you're just kind of out there on your own reading this book, trying to make connections to the Puritans, I don't know that you can necessarily be successful doing that. But as a, you know, almost 30-year-old who moved away from home and has a little bit more life experience, I'm drawing the parallels that maybe should have been drawn back then. And we, again, we've talked about it, you know, growing up in a small community, and especially in a small school, and people being marked by, you know, what happened in high school, or any time really, because I mean, I think it happens to people outside of high school too. And you just know everything about everybody. But I didn't see that back then. My worldview was very, very small, and it's not huge now. There's definitely more to learn, but it's definitely bigger than it was. So does that answer the question? I have no idea what
yes, definitely.
Okay.
No, completely I totally blacked agree. Out. I mean, I think that although it sounds like I didn't grow up in as small of a town as Madeline, like I definitely grew up in a small town with very small-minded people, small thinking patterns, don't really think outside of the box or else you're going to get in trouble. And so aside from the fact that I couldn't really read this book in 10th grade,
yeah,
not to mention understand the bigger themes behind the book, I was just seeing somebody who, you know, small town guy from the South. Oh, it's a woman. She got pregnant out of wedlock. That's bad.
You take it at a very base level back then.
Yeah. Everything I thought about this book was based on, like I was saying before, you know, not necessarily my family's background, but like the exposure that I had to the Baptist church, which was sinful thoughts, you're going to go to hell. Sinful actions, you're going to go to hell even more. You know, it's that baseline of sex before marriage, hell.
Yeah.
Bad thoughts, hell. Not to mention being a gay man from a
Right.
small town in the South, below hell. Like, it's like, great. Love that for me.
Yeah,
I think that I came from this just kind of ingesting everything that was being told to me, like what the book was about.
Yeah.
And so going back on it, and even, you know, like me flippantly, like kind of twisting it and being like, what if she was the villain, like trying to add some of those kind of nuances to it. Like, I had fun with that. Like, you know, trying to think from a different perspective, like trying to think from, as Madeline put it, like a villager's perspective. I like was able to kind of enter the minds of the different characters to be like, what would they think about this? You know, what are some of the different perspectives that go into this, you know, critically acclaimed work?
That's, I think, a mindset that only age brings. I think that well, even more than age, maybe getting away from your hometown. I think there's something, and all three of us have done this, when you leave and then you come back and you're just like, you're a completely different person than you ever were.
Yeah. And no, I think that's a good point. I feel like the 10th grade Luke could not have at all put himself in anybody else's mind. You're faced with the text, even if you don't read the text, you're faced with the facts that are being thrown at you by the teacher. Mm-hmm. And so that's what you ingest. And, you know, that's what the book's about.
Yeah.
Right.
And even if you don't understand the bigger themes that are at play here, it's like, it's a much different experience. Granted, I haven't read the full book to this day, but I've seen the films. And so I can take all of those sources of information and draw out my own conclusions from that information. And I realized that I have not done this yet. And so I mentioned I wanted to give a disclaimer about Wikipedia and how it's been villainized, just like Hester has been in this episode. It is not the villain that we all make it out to be. You just cannot use it as a primary source or even a secondary source. But you absolutely can use Wikipedia for a first stop glance at whatever you're researching.
Oh, yeah.
You just have to make sure to scroll all the way down to the very, very bottom where it mentions all of the resources. And then you to click on those individual references and then go see those for themselves. A lot of those are probably secondary sources. And so you have to go even further. But this is something that I learned in library school, because growing up, even in college, it's like Wikipedia's the devil, since we're talking about, you know, Puritan Massachusetts. You know, I sound like the mom from The Waterboy, you know, Wikipedia's the devil. Love Kathy Bates. She's a gem. But yeah, it honestly is such a great source for, you know, information, and just to get a snapshot of whatever you're researching, use Wikipedia, but also use it as a source. Use it as
starting
for whatever research you're doing.
Yeah.
Like I said, it's not anything that's new. It's not groundbreaking. It's just a reminder that, you know, you might come across people in your professional or academic career that will say, Wikipedia is wrong. It's bad. I did work for the Queens Public Library in college, creating Wikipedia pages, trying to make sure that they're factually accurate.
It is an important source. I think it's all a little moot now, though, for all these little children, because they just use AI.
Yeah, that's totally true, which is sad. But, you know, I'm hoping the little children are not listening, and I'm hoping the big children will get my drift. Like,
big children. Wikipedia is good. Donate to them.
That. I just went on my little sidebar there.
It is really interesting hearing how you guys both were like taught it or took it, because it feels like Nathaniel Hawthorne says society and, you know, making a living sermon bad, like this does bad things to people. But it feels like you get the surface level. You are told exactly the opposite of it. Like you come away with like, oh, she does this bad thing, gets put on her chest, and it follows her forever. She is described as a living sermon to the town in the book, and we treat her exactly the same way in that first like cursory read. And if you don't like devote a lot of time to sort of sitting back, well, also, this was one of the first ever like mass produced books, like widely published, especially in the US. So like, I think that's just like re- reading was different then. Like, I mean, this wasn't for children, obviously.
Yeah.
But like in 1850, you are like sitting down with a book and you're able to like draw conclusions about people's patterns of behavior. Yeah, it's like,
yeah.
Why? Here's a question I wrote. I said earlier, like, why do we teach these to these kids? And maybe a lot of it is because we always have. But also, like, what do we want at the end of the unit or whatever, when our high schoolers finish reading Scarlet Letter, what do we want kids to have taken from it? Like, what is the lesson we're hoping they get? Is it just, we learned about Puritans, so now we have to read this book? You know, what are we hoping they get?
I think there's a handful of different things. Hopefully we're teaching our young gentlemen to think about women as more than just objects, because I think there are a lot of books that don't do that. And then, I mean, it's a principles and a moral story, right? I mean, it's essentially this feels like oversimplified, but the think outside the box. I mean, you know, you have this whole society of people, and I feel like we've iterated this and reiterated this, but like we have this whole society of people who see this one woman in a certain way, and they don't realize until later, oh, hey, actually. So, I mean, is it that we're, you know, we need to, I don't know. I don't know what they want.
I've got
a very simplistic idea.
Yes.
And it's probably going to sound ignorant, but this is also 10th grade Luke creeping into my head. And it's just, to me, I think part of this comes from Erin saying that she didn't have this exposure to the book in her school.
Yeah,
more,
definitely.
More liberal, whatever, like higher thinking, whatever. Mm-hmm. Public school, maybe it's as simple as don't get people pregnant.
Yeah.
If you're not ready.
Yeah.
Like I said,
pregnancy. Yeah.
Ignorant. It sounds simple, but like,
it's not a bad thing to take from the book.
You're not ready for it, bitch. Oh. Like, it's showing you all of the things that can go wrong. It's bad for the woman. You're going to die if you get a woman pregnant.
Yeah.
Like, and that you can't escape it. Yeah.
This is very extreme, but that's kind of my, like, when you ask that question, Erin, that's my first thought is like, why do we teach this to high schoolers specifically? Don't get women pregnant. Don't have sex.
What was it? Mean Girls? Don't have sex. You will get pregnant, then you will
die.
You
will get chlamydia and you will die.
Having had it taught in class, did that part at least come across? Did you leave classroom saying, yeah, that'd be bad?
Well,
like, did that even?
As somebody who did not have sex until they were 18, sure.
Mm-hmm.
It's
yeah.
like, and I also wouldn't have engaged in sex with Hester Prynne. So it's not really my problem, but I probably would have been the toxic bitch who went after Dimmesdale, to be honest. Like,
oh,
I would
no.
have seduced his ass and he would have been a goner from the get-go. Like,
you're just bored.
Hanging
out with chickens all day.
I would have been wearing the Scarlet Letter.
Oh, fuck. No, I have been terrified of pregnancy and small children since I was about 5. So I knew from the get-go. I was like, this is not going to be an issue for me in any way, shape, or form.
A crazy tiny detail is that when Pearl is playing, among the list of things that she does, one is she lays out a jellyfish to melt in the warm sun. I was like, that's animal abuse.
I don't like Pearl. She's
but also like from a writing perspective,
the narcissistic tendencies of her mother, and she's now abusing animals.
Because she's born of sin.
She is born
she
of sin,
is
and she's also
the
a narcissist,
devil.
Just like her mother.
I keep
that's what narcissism
picturing
is.
In my head,
oh, God.
The Breaking Dawn, the Renesmee animatronic doll with the big eyes, and for me, that is Pearl.
I don't like Pearl.
Yeah.
I don't like Renesmee either.
I enjoy Pearl.
I don't have enough of an opinion about Pearl to really give her the dragging that she deserves, but...
Yeah, she's just a small child.
I don't like her. I think she's problematic. I think she's troublesome.
Do you not like her
first,
on like a personal level or like a... I like her on
like
a
women.
Writing level.
It is a personal thing for me. Like,
yeah.
And I think a lot of it's imposed on, like it was imposed by her mother. The fact that she like made her such a staple in the town to be like, hey, this is my whore. Like, sorry. Cut that. No, this is my
whore spawn.
I've been trying to keep it together.
Oh,
Apparently,
oh.
part of myself came out right then. I'm sorry.
Oh.
No, I was gonna say, as a man, I get like the word whore can be problematic for some people. I love the word whore. I think it fits in a
Sure.
lot of circumstances. Like, I'm also not a woman, but like, not only women are whores. Like, I have been a whore many times in my life. So,
Yeah.
like, not being
Whore is a
paid,
state of
like,
mind at this point.
I've been a whore. Like, it's a mindset, I think.
I think I've
Like,
called more men a whore in the last couple of years than I have women, for sure.
and God damn it, it's true.
Okay, so we were talking
So.
about like what are we hoping people get out of the book, right? I feel like English class always had like, okay, what's the main idea? Or
Yeah.
in a more maybe academic way, like what is the author's thesis? And this one moment felt like, okay, he's saying it. Or like if this isn't all of them, this is one of them, and he's pointing to it. No man for any considerable period can wear one face to himself and another to the multitude without finally getting bewildered as to which may be the true.
I like
And
that.
then,
I think that's
yeah.
a good like synopsis.
There's this moment where, and I don't know if, not to be rude, I don't know if you guys have seen this scene because it's at the end of the book. But just before Dimmesdale dies, he like does
Wow,
this
the
big confession.
shade. Yeah,
Well,
shade.
well,
Don't know if y'all have seen this or not because you didn't read the
was
book,
I don't know. You haven't said it yet, so maybe
I
not.
mean, I thought we were just gonna let it be unknown. I mean, I thought we were just gonna,
Well,
but
Dimmesdale
Aaron
dies.
called us out. It's fine.
He dies? No.
Dimmesdale dies. And
Spoiler.
just before he does, he preaches this sermon where he confesses, but he doesn't. And then he tears down his shirt and he's
Ready?
right. But the way it's written, he says, "Behold, behold a dreadful witness of it." With a convulsive motion, he tore away the ministerial band from before his breast. It was revealed, but it were irreverent to describe that revelation. That's all they describe of it. He shows this thing that we know, I feel like it's insinuated. It's the same as Hester's, but it's burned into his skin. It's like understood. But the description is he pulls it away, it was revealed, but it were irreverent to describe that revelation. And that's it.
Sounds like he's trying to give him a way out. Like, I don't know,
Yeah.
you're not trying to like he's been beating Hester over the head with a freaking broom, and
Yeah.
then you're just gonna be like, oh yeah, irreverent, whatever Aaron just said. Like he's
Like,
like
we have to look at Hester's punishment for 7 years.
Yes,
And
that's not
Dimmesdale
fair.
pulls it down and immediately dies. And he describes that A so much and doesn't at all for Arthur. But Hester also leans into that. She embroiders her A. She makes it gorgeous and beautiful and draw the eye. And he
And he ignores
hides.
it,
Yeah,
and he did until he fucking died.
yeah, and by the point that he does reveal it, does anybody really care?
No, nobody cares.
Yeah.
They're probably
Because
sad
at
that
that
their master
point,
just passed away.
yeah, he's beloved. And at that point, it's like he doesn't have to have any consequences. So, like, we can stop thinking about it as a community. And there's also, like, he describes it in the books, like, after a while, just like Hester's ours. And, like, she has her role in the community. And, like, yeah, it sucks. We're not gonna be her friend. But, like,
And
she's part of
now
it.
he's like, here I am. And they're like, oh, well, that solves that mystery. And then he dies. And then they immediately post his job on LinkedIn.
What do we think if you're an onlooker, if you're a Puritan, you know, wearing the little hats and the bonnets, like what are you
The shoes, the
thinking
buckles.
in the
Oh my God.
buckles and the shoes? And honestly,
The
there's
little
some
can of
craft behind
balloons.
all of that. If you're an onlooker and he's just like professing himself to the world or his village, and he dies, and then you see the, not that it's spelled out in the text, but like you see the A, what do you think? Like, oh, that's my pastor. He's going to heaven. He's in a better place.
Yeah.
Heathen sinner.
They even know what it's about. I
If
feel
there's an
like they would
A
see
in the
it,
test, I
and
mean,
there's like a
I mean,
horror, but not like
strokes out in front of everybody.
exactly. That's such a good question of like, if you were in the audience, how would you perceive it? And I think the thing that first came to my mind is like, oh my God, he had that for so long. Like my mind is like, oh my God, that looks like it hurts. Like, ouchie.
Oh my God, that's like, the opposite of like, me.
Is there this mentality of like, oh, no, suffering? Oh, yeah, I don't know. What makes me think that?
I think I
as a villager, not as Aaron.
Yeah, my snap thought here is that very practically, I'm blind as fuck. I'd be in the back of the crowd going, I don't know what did he just do? What did he just do? And I'd be relying on everybody else to tell me what he did. And so I'm assuming something would get lost there.
And then it's a game of telephone.
Yes.
Because at that point, would you just gasp? Would people try to like hide it? Would someone be there, like the governor or something, like the people who, you know, who like made this man part of it? Would they be like, don't look? And then if there's blind guys in the back, no one is going to be like, wow, it's a red A, just like Hester's. Yeah. Everyone probably, there's a hush and there's a silence and someone could be like, oh my God, Dimmesdale just died. And you think that's what it's about.
Yeah. Well, because he's like a village elder or something like that. He's one of the important dudes. So I'm assuming, people would probably try and cover it up. They know what it was about or what, but I honestly, how many years have passed at this point?
Seven at least.
That jogs a question in my mind. How many other damn secrets is this man keeping?
Yeah.
We haven't mentioned this yet. He's a shady bitch.
Yes.
And how many other secrets is he keeping?
I feel that way about the whole town. A degree to me that I'm like, what's the gossip? Like, I want to hear everyone's little story, talked about small insular communities. Yeah. Speaking of newspapers, one of the only things I saw about Nathaniel Hawthorne is he self-published a newspaper at 16. He gave out seven copies.
He should have posted a mock newspaper of this village.
Yeah.
Do we ever get a name?
That would be such a good assignment.
That would be
It's Salem.
My gosh. You're so
That'd be such a good assignment.
Aaron, the English teacher. Oh my goodness.
We had to do something like that in like fifth grade. Because when we did a book report or whatever, it had to be a folder. And so, you did like a summary of it or whatever. And then you had to either a front cover of a magazine, which is what I did because I like to draw. Mm-hmm. So I don't even remember what book I did anymore. But other people did like a newspaper. Had to like little tiny articles or whatever about it, but are right on track. She'd be a great
God, but that sounds not fun.
Oh, it's not.
And I also like feel so much anxiety around children. I always have, either from I'm gonna physically break you or like
I think it's just only them.
Like people have always told me that I'm very good around children.
Yeah.
Like I interact well with them. And obviously I did for 2.5 years while I worked at the museum.
Yeah.
And I have 5 nieces. So it's kind of forced upon me. But I typically, like, if I come across a child in the wild, I'm usually not like,
where'd you come from?
I'm like, go back to your parent.
I like them best from a distance.
I feel like doing this podcast, I have so much sympathy for kids. There's just like, they're so young. They don't know anything.
Yeah.
They don't have the resources to feel it and like understand it.
That's a good point. Like going back to like thinking about 10th grade year old Luke. Yeah. It's like, you were not that I wasn't, I was given everything I needed, but I'm like, you could have been better supported as a kid.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Not necessarily from family, but like,
It's it's a bewildering time. Like it's a hard thing to grow up, even if like you have all the right circumstances and stuff. It's just a hard thing.
But we made it.
We made it, and
we didn't end up like Pearl. Gosh.
Well, Pearl marries up, doesn't she? Isn't that in like the finale? No.
I didn't read the book. God.
But it was in Spark Notes. You should have read Spark Notes. Mary's like European nobility or something.
I'm sorry, everybody. I'm a fraud.
I'm sorry. Me too.
So I'm just going to go to the final question.
Oh, yeah.
Love the final question.
Do you consider it required reading? Madeline is shaking her head. No.
No. I would consider this, avoid this reading.
Yeah.
I want to publish my own edited version, and then I think it would be a
Yes.
really good book. But even then, not really required reading, but just
Yeah.
fun.
It's a good story. Like that, and that's the thing, is it's a good story. There are a couple of really good, solid characters in there. I think you can get some good themes and subtexts and morals and blah 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 out of it, but God, what a
Yeah.
dry man Nathaniel Hawthorne.
I'm gonna say no because I think a lot of people would. I'm gonna say no because I think a lot of students would resonate with what I've talked about as far as not being able to read a straight book, let alone a book with language like this, where there's all of the 17th century-esque writing that makes it so much more difficult to read in the first place.
Yeah, it's a guy in 1850 writing like 1605 or something. So there's
Yeah,
layers
like
and layers of it.
mid-1600s, I think, is when it's set. So that alone creates barriers for people like me where I just can't do that. And so that discourages me from reading it at all, let alone am I going to read it, understand what I'm reading, and then pick up on the larger themes that are embedded within the text. I mean, it's just not going to happen. So for that reason, I think it shouldn't be required. Not to mention,
I agree.
it's outdated themes, like
Yes.
having a
Sin.
woman out of wedlock, like that's not uncommon nowadays. It's not seen as taboo.
I feel like
I yeah.
Hawthorne's views differ from the views of the community, but if you are not reading like at an extremely high and close level, if you
Yeah.
are, in high school and this is one of 10 assignments you have and all of that, it's very easy to miss it and not get it and
Yeah.
sort of do the opposite of what Hawthorne intended.
I think this is like a grad school book,
Oh,
but in
yeah.
terms of like high school, I think there are other classics, there are classic literature that you can get the same themes and the same kind of ideas from. I always don't know why, couldn't tell you why, but I always drew direct comparisons, a lot of the because in 11th grade, when I did American literature the second time, different professor, obviously, a bit of a higher level. She taught this from a bit of a feminist perspective, I think, because she was a very women in literature. Hell yeah. But I always compared this to Little Women. I think that is a far more effective book to have teenagers read.
And it
I
was written
think
as a
it,
children's book.
yes, but
yeah,
it's,
I never read that one.
oh, you should. Oh,
Nor
you should.
was
I
it
didn't
required.
until like 3 years ago.
And
Madeline, I'm not hearing criticism of that movie at this time. Thank you.
Winona Ryder was in there.
That is the movie that I prefer, is the Winona Ryder Christian Bale. But also in that movie, I think that Joe and Laurie do belong together. But overall, in the book, Joe should not be with a man.
No.
That's a lesbian. We don't need to talk about it. We're not talking about Little Women. But I think that's a far more
Not
effective
yet.
book. Not yet. Have you done Little Women? You've done Little Women.
I haven't. I mean, they have to be parts that, or like just
That's, yeah.
chapters.
Yeah.
That
She's a
book
thick boy. She's a
is
thick boy.
yeah.
But that's, and that's, you could teach an entire class on that book. Anyway,
Oh
it's
yeah.
not, Once Upon a Time.
But again, what I'm saying is that that book is written for children. Like, there's not a bad
Yes.
thing. Like, adults' books can be good for adults, and you can, like, there's nothing wrong
Yeah.
with giving a child a. It's like the best way to meet a
Yes.
child is meet them where they're at.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a huge thing I've
Yes.
learned.
And especially, because they're, essentially preteens and teenagers, right? And that's what age we'd be talking about with American literature. And it's kind of in the same area. It's New England, right? It's Civil War. We're
Absolutely.
teach the
Yeah, I mean
crucible for the Puritans
yeah.
and the witch trials, and then just move on.
Yeah,
Like I said,
especially
I
because like
love the crucible.
a play, I think,
Well,
is a lot more accessible for a
yes.
classroom.
Yes. I think
Absolutely.
okay, so Once Upon a Time is what I was about to say is back in high school, I wanted to be a lawyer and I wanted to work in education reform. So if that's where a lot of this
Incredible.
comes from. But yeah, the play, I think you need to warm kids up to the finding the themes and the subplots and the
Yeah.
subtext. And so
Yeah.
plays are a perfect, you sit there with the class and you sign everybody apart and you read it together, and you talk about it.
Yeah.
And then you make them read it on
Perfect.
their own. It's great.
Well, it's been almost 3 hours.
Sorry.
We
At least.
took breaks. We
And made it
started like
happen.
halfway through. Thank you so much. Where would you like people to find you if you want to be found? You can say nowhere.
Don't find me. Hopefully, Aaron will let me back on for another book,
Oh,
but I'm
yeah.
more. Not that I wasn't excited about this. Like I said, the Puritan aspect of this made me excited, but I felt
This
like
might
this.
be our first hate read.
Have
Oh my
you? Oh,
God.
yeah.
Honestly, I feel like if we do another one, we need to do another trio. Like,
Yeah.
I feel like this is, I feel like we're a good trio.
Yeah.
Yes. I feel like that would be really fun to do another one. Maybe it's Little Women.
That's
I
like a
would re
10-parter. That's
I
like
would
my
probably
goodness.
reread a little bit, but
Oh my goodness. Yes. Like, so sorry, Aaron. I just like didn't answer your question. Don't find me.
they don't want to be found.
We don't want to.
Oh no.
I'm speaking for Madeline. Don't find us.
Oh,
Oh
you can find me on Instagram if you want a pet portrait or a people portrait or any other kind of painting. Please help me pay my rent. And then you'll be able to find me in Maine soon. I'm moving in April.
that's
So
exciting.
yeah, I'm
Yeah.
gonna go
Maine's really
fishing.
nice. Do you mind saying what part?
We think Bangor-ish.
Oh, I've never been there. I've driven through Maine when I was like five. And
Yeah.
then I've been to Bar Harbor.
Love Bar Harbor.
Isn't
We went.
Bangor where John Philip Sousa is from?
No idea, but that's where
Oh my
Stephen
goodness, are
King
you gonna
lives.
write the national anthem again?
Yes, I'm gonna rewrite it. I'm also gonna rewrite all of Stephen King's books.
The national anthem. That
There
wasn't
goes.
John Philip Sousa, was it? That was
No, National
Edward
Anthem
Hopkins.
was where I'm from, Frederick Keys. Yeah,
Okay,
that's where I'm
okay.
from. If I was
You're
not from a specific place,
yeah.
that specific place, I wouldn't have known.
I mean, there's also there's the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Maryland, so like that's a
Well, there
thing.
was.
Maybe not anymore.
Did they get rid of it? Are they rebuilding
No,
it?
it was like a really bad accident.
I figured
Yeah.
they would rebuild
Well,
it
I
or
don't know.
something.
I should know. I don't know. Oops.
You're from
Talk
Maryland, Aaron. I need
to
the answers.
Yeah.
Anne. Talk to Anne.
Oh. Yes, Anne, what's happening with the bridge?
Oh
Let me know
no.
in the
Are
comments
you ever
below.
going to have Anne on this
There's no
podcast?
comments below, but it's fine.
Thanks for listening to this episode. I'm going to end the recording. All right, thank you so much to Luke and Madeline for this great episode. Next week, we're gonna do maybe for a couple weeks a little mini-sode or two. So I think we're going to cover movies. I'm considering Swan Princess and Barbie Swan Lake, maybe together. I'm also thinking about doing some movie adaptations of some books we've done. So I might. Watch some of those Scarlet Letters. Maybe I'll start from the very beginning with The Summer I Turned Pretty. You know what? You're welcome for that burp. I apologize. And I'll see you next week. You can find me everywhere at Erin R. Bowles. And if you would like to support the podcast, please do if you can. We're at buymeacoffee.com/required reading. Goodbye. And thank you for the long episode. I know it's long. We're gonna keep them short. Thank you. We just had two guests, so double the stuff to say. Okay, now I'm really done. Bye.